I'm joined by Professor of Psychology at Trinity College Dublin, Ian Robertson, the author of The Winner Effect, who joins us occasionally to take a look at the psychology behind some of the big news events of the last week or so. We're going to discuss, so good morning to Ian, by the way.
Good morning, Miles.
We're going to discuss the psychology of the Spanish rail crash and the royal birth, two totally and utterly disparate topics. But you've written about the rail crash, partly from a personal loss, a sense of personal loss that you experienced with a colleague in the 1990s. Tell us about that.
Yes. Her name was Ruth Holland, and she was the associate editor in the British Medical Journal. I used to have a column in there, and Ruth saved me from a few scrapes from my articles. And then one day she took the 5 o'clock train home to Watford, and unfortunately the train crashed into another train, and she was the only person killed on the train. And I actually had another colleague who was killed in a train crash. And both of these crashes, in the Ruth Holland one, the driver passed through two yellow signals. And he also passed through a red signal, and hence he crashed. But he claimed there was some obscuring of the red signal by the branches. But the inquiry did find he passed through two signals at caution. And I've been for many years studying this phenomenon of how you keep your mind on what you're doing, even in routine situations. And what train drivers and DART drivers and London Underground drivers, what they have to do is to keep alert when there's nothing externally keeping them alert. There's nothing novel happening. So they go through a light 1,000 times and it's always green. So the brain is programmed just to get into automatic pilot and habitual mode. And it's very hard to keep alert and not slip into that automatic pilot, which is what happened with that driver in Ruth Holland's train.
And in the case of Francisco Garzon, the driver in Spain, he's told investigators that he was on the phone to the control centre when the train crashed.
Yeah.
So that obviously would be a contributory factor there.
Yes, but I mean, I think the control centre phoned him. But so what he had to, apparently, what happened was, there was in quite a short period of time, he had to reduce from fast speed to a slow speed. So that required you to be focusing your attention. In a journey he'd done many, many times, you had to be present-minded for that period. And so, and particularly if you're on the phone, it'd be very easy to just miss that and to keep an automatic pilot, as he seems to have done.
You've studied concentration lapses, as you said, over a quarter of a century. What have you discovered about repetitive routines like train or bus driving? And there must be many, many more competitive routines, but those are particularly important because they're potentially dangerous.
Yes. Handling machinery, flying. Take flying, for instance. Pilots have to go through the most intensive checklist routine between the pilot and the co-pilot before they take off. It's they have their checklists and they go, you know, flaps check, lights check, and this is all designed to keep their attention on what they're doing, because it's so easy. Because anything we get into used to doing as a routine, the brain easily gets bored.
But then, of course, the pilot ends up, and it has become the operative phrase for what we're talking about, automatic pilot. You go on automatic pilot.
That's right. You go on automatic pilot. But the problem is you need to keep that pilot awake for the rare occasions when routine is broken. And you know, that's why people drive off roads at night when they're getting drowsy, because drowsiness reduces your attention. That's why you can sometimes be reading a newspaper or a book article and realise for the last minute or two you haven't actually been taking it in, because your attention has drifted. And it turns out that's really important for our mental health as well.
I mentioned at the top of the programme, in the menu at the top of the programme, why millions of dollars are spent building apparently unnecessary bends in motorways. And I'm sure people were scratching their heads thinking, what in the name of God is that about? This is what it's about, because you have a fascinating point about the building of motorways. Tell us about that.
Yes, civil engineering, you know, if you have a perfectly flat plane, and if you go to parts of Ireland and in England where they've got long motorways going across the plain, you'll sometimes find almost always find there are bends at some time built into the roads, at times where there isn't an obvious geographical obstacle or swamp that you might assume it's because someone refused to sell the land or something. In actual fact, engineers, by trial and error over the century, ever since Hitler started building the roads and motorways in the 30s, they found that by trial and error, they've had to build bends into straight roads, because otherwise people just drive off them. Because that part of that network in their brain that keeps us alert in routine situations it needs to be given a little bit of an external push now and again to keep it alert. And having a bend in the road just gives that bit of external stimulus to help us do that very difficult task, which is keep our mind on routine activities.
So it kind of wakens you up. I mean, I'm not saying, I don't mean literally wakens you up, but it does, in a sense, wake
almost
you up.
Literally,
it's a change.
Almost literally wakens you up, because that part of the brain for maintaining concentration is very much closely linked to our sleepiness cycle as well. And, you know, you're sleepy very 4 o'clock in the morning, and after lunch you have these dips. That's all linked to a brain chemical messenger called noradrenaline, among others. And this system for focusing attention that seemed to lapse in the Spanish train crash is closely linked to that chemical messenger.
Okay, so that's an attention system that has to be internally controlled in some way.
Yeah,
there
yeah.
are situations, though, many situations in which attention is externally controlled, in which, in a sense, somebody else is in charge.
Yeah, when I was training as a clinical psychologist in London, there was a very famous psychiatrist there who had studied attention deficit disorder in children. And he had a theory that there was nothing wrong with attention in attention deficit disorder children. He thought there was something else wrong. It was to do with their response to rewards. And one of his reasons for saying was that this was that these children could play computer games for long, long periods, and their attention seemed fine. And he assumed that this could not be the case. But actually, computer games are designed to engineer your attention externally in the way the civil engineers engineer your attention with the bends in the roads, but much more attractively with colours, novelty, excitement. So that your brain can be under external control of that, and you're absolutely fine. So that's why if there was a sudden snowstorm, the train, that would switch on the attention system of the driver. But it's when you're in routine that ability to self-sustain attention is compromised.
A text had just come in wanting to know what is the psychology behind finding certain accents so appealing, i.e. your guest's delicious Scottish accent.
Ah, well, that's very nice of him, but sometimes it's tough when you give what you think is a very good lecture, and I remember in America doing that and someone came up and said, "You've got such a lovely accent."
I didn't listen to a word you said. I just listened to the accent. Well, yeah. I suppose it's better than somebody coming up to you and say, "I didn't understand a word you're saying."
Yes,
I couldn't penetrate your accent. Okay, moving on from that to the birth of a royal prince in Britain. It's obviously boosted the morale of the nation. But what about the future mental health and well-being of the child, of the baby himself?
Well, it's a tough call, being a child of a very successful, very powerful person. If you look back to the predecessors of the current princeling, Edward VII, Victoria's son, was a dissolute disappointment to his parents. And he finally got to the throne age 60.
For a few years
until he died in 1910. And then his son, George V, took over. So at least he was only 44 when he took over. But he said of his son, the future Edward VII, Edward VIII, he said, "After I am dead, the lad will ruin himself in 12 months.
That was a very interesting prediction.
And within 10 months, he'd abdicated. Yeah. And then George VI, his brother, who didn't want to be king, who, if we believe the king's speech, really was terrorized by his father. He was a stuttering, very nervous man who did a great job as monarch. And then we have Prince Charles, who's, eccentric, if you like, and who is a great, difficulty being his own man because of the status and power and the fame of his parents. And that's true for anyone, for any person. In some ways, it can be as tough being born into poverty and having to make your way as to be born a child of a very successful parent, depending on what success does to that parent's ego and brain.
But I mean, what you're talking about there are you know, a series of royals who, in their own way, are maladjusted. I mean, clearly the sons of George V had a very, very tough time coming to terms with themselves, coming to terms with their position or whatever. That does not seem to be the case with Kate and William. They seem to be, you know, pretty level-headed, pretty centred individuals, considering what has happened to certainly to one of them anyway.
Well, I would say that you can only draw on what you see in the media, that that's probably the case, that somehow the awful hubris, if you like, that went with being a royal in previous generations was to a certain extent lost, maybe because of cultural and generational changes, maybe because Diane didn't spend more time with her children in a way the previous, the current queen did not. She didn't have much to do with her children when they were growing up. Very distant mother. So, and maybe, you know, I suspect William is going to be a much more kind of metrosexual, kind of hands-on father, and so we might well not have the similar psychological problems to the ones we've seen in previous generations.
And talk to me a little bit about the importance of ego, of an inflated ego in a parent, and what effect that can have, what effect it can have on them and on their belief systems, and what effect then in turn it can have on their children.
Well, success and status and power all have powerful drug-like effects on your brain. And there's an awful psychological trap, and all of us will be able to think of bosses we know in whom success have gone to their head, or celebrities in whom success has gone to their head. And what that means is they become narcissistic, at the very least extremely egotistical. And very powerful people, business people, political leaders, who get great power, their judgment gets distorted, their brains actually get changed by the chemistry of power, such that they start to believe themselves to be unique.
This is that sense of entitlement.
It's a sense of entitlement, and it's also a sense of specialness, a sense in which somehow God is involved in your greatness. Tony Blair had a bit of it. They start to talk in terms of we, the royal we. Tony Blair confessed that, let slip to Michael Parkinson that that God maybe was involved a bit in his decisions about Iraq. George Bush, the same. John Pelgetti Sr. Believed he was the reincarnation of the Emperor Hadrian. Pablo Picasso called himself El Rey, the king, and his staff called themselves the sun. It's very difficult for a child to be a son or daughter, particularly a son of a father in whom success has gone to their head in that way. Because if my father is the sun, then there's no ladder for me. And that's a phrase Fiona Doherty, clinical psychologist, my wife, led me to understand. You hide the ladder of achievement from your children if you let success go to your head and believe and fall into the trap of believing it's something unique.
The sun you're talking about, by the way, is the S-U-N.
S-U-N, that's right. S-O-N.
We are talking about father-son relationships, just to clarify that.
Yeah.
And this notion then of hiding the ladder, tell me a little bit more about that. Why are they doing this? Are they doing this because they want their children to start from scratch rather than to start from a position of privilege? Why are they hiding the ladder, as it were?
It took me years to understand this, and it took Fiona to explain it to me painfully, because I hadn't, because we lived in Cambridge for a number of years, and she was struck. She kept mentioning to me about how many of the successful parents that we mixed with, top academics in Cambridge, a significant proportion of their children was so underachieved, and the way Picasso's son underachieved. Why was that? And it took me years, and I was writing The Winner Effect, and I said, what is it about this? And she said, well, if a parent's success goes to their head and they start to believe themselves to be uniquely endowed and special, that can end up being an insurmountable barrier to a child. Whereas if the parent is honest and says, look, and I say this of myself, I am very lucky to be a professor at Trinity College Dublin. There's plenty of people in my class smarter than me. I was very lucky to be in Cambridge and have a job there. I worked very hard. I persisted through failure. I had times, failure. If business people and politicians recognise and are honest with their children of the true determinants of success, which are to do with chance, to do, and business people, how many businesses fail? How many top business people think they're there because they're so brilliant? And they're not, they were lucky. And they persisted. And they had the breaks. Many other brilliant businessmen didn't have the breaks.
Because if a child believes that their parent has achieved because they are special in some way, they look at themselves and they think, well, I'm not particularly special, so there's no guarantee that I'm going to achieve, so I won't even try.
I call it the curse of genetic fatalism in the book. If you believe that somehow there's a finger, a genetic or a religion or a deity that fingers you as special, I am chosen, I'm born into this, there's nothing you can do. It disables you. There's nothing you can do.
And that doesn't even take into consideration the disabling factor of attempting to live up to the achievements of a parent.
Exactly.
It's a different thing altogether.
Exactly. And the greatest and most important brain nurturing thing for a child is success experiences. And so you have to be able to see that you can set goals and achieve them. But if you have a parent who appears effortlessly successful, then you don't have the model, you don't have the example of achieving success through effort, and it's very easy to give up and become a dropout, as we saw in many colleagues in Cambridge.
Well, we'll wish George Alexander Louis the best of luck in life. I'd say he's probably unlikely to become a dropout, unlikely to end up on Skid Row, may become a dropout in all sorts of other ways. But Ian, thank you very much.
Thank you, Miles.
Ian Robertson's the author of The Winner Effect, and you can find his website at professorianrobertson.wordpress.com and on Twitter at IH Robertson. That's Ian Robertson. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.